This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Okay, so first of all, I'm actually extremely happy to welcome the first five speakers at this panel. The actual interest in the first panel, the one that I would like to organize, is that I truly admire actually the work that is being unearthed in all of the five examples. And my guests here are A.L. Weisman, Director of Goldsmith Center for Architecture Research, architect and writer and friend, Keller Easterling, writer and architect from Yale University, Manuel Hertz, who is a faculty at the ETH Studio Basel and also an architect from Cologne, Sanjay Krishnan, associate professor in English department at the University of Pennsylvania, and Laura Kurgan, Director of Visual Studies and Director of the Spatial Information Design Lab, both at Columbia University. As a first of the three sessions on the so-called provisory evasions of architectural conference, I would like to just bring in something that started our interest into the work of these people. The first panel really is meant to be to look at to ask actually my colleagues how do they what did they recently found, how is anything that is found in the field actually in any way categorizable or understandable, or how do we work with that? My case that actually baffles me, and I'm sure that everybody has their own cases, is the one that I would simply like to explain, is an image which was used throughout the announcing of the evasions of power. And actually, for me, it is something that is also one of the last, kicks of system that was holding together in the last Western Balkan countries called Yugoslavia. Here we see actually atop of a mountain a movement of two people, foundations, and an object being shipped to its location. And this very image and sort of its staging of its happening is something that I'm trying to explain in my own work. Can we go to the next slide? But in fact, the very act of this moving of this object to its foundation is a series of three major evasive policies. One is that it happens on the border of two countries once being together, Serbia and Montenegro, and it happens on a blurry border where it is not clear, politically it is clear which territory belongs to which side, but it is not entirely clear in religious term which denomination of an Orthodox church run by both countries is going to claim it. And in this war of claiming of tops of hills, another evasive aspect happens is that a military is used to ship a previously built container that is going to be sacralized and will become an Orthodox church. That turns into the final evasion of a so-called canonistic architecture of an Orthodox Christian church, which does not allow buildings being built on anything other than stone and brick. And if we examine the object, can we go to the next one, please? Next, please. Actually, first, if we examine the position of this top, which can be seen from five countries in the region, and the cities that are starting to grow. Next, please. And if we go closer to the object is a complete evasion of a fundamentally promoted canon of orthodoxy. Now, that poses a question from us, what is then the discourse that can actually just not try to explain this, but go parallel with it and sort of learn with it as such? And I think there is one more after this. But if one goes down to the ground in the very valley of the top, one sees that this is not a solitary case, that we may be behind in a certain way of actually combining, ruthlessly combining, not just methods of construction, but also methods of identification. And if we go to the next one, please, and even find examples which are actually claiming to be a new breed of anonymous high architecture. These both examples are from contemporary Kosovo, which is, again, another incredible systematic evasion par excellence, because as you may know, Kosovo will become a country. It has just given permission by the European Commission to be promoted into an independent country with a supervision on top of it, which is something that we can discuss on a totally different conference. But these set of decisions that are being played fully amount to what I would like to kind of introduce to this table, discussing the work of the four people. So I would like to start with Eyal. Hi. Welcome. And actually, I'm asking everybody to speak 5 to 10 minutes. And so we need to be quick.
Thank you, surgeons and the organizers. It's absolutely great to be here. And I'd actually like to respond to the brief of this conference, or the way in which I understood it, quite literally. And this is kind of before hearing Aaron sort of complicating already the notion of evasions, and show various ways by which oppositionary action in conflict zones, being made complicit with the aim of government power or the military in control. Again, this is an issue. The issue of complicity is always one of degrees. So the kind of the moment from which the degree of complicity stops serving the interest of victims. Again, the interest of victims in itself is something which is very varied and need to be discussed, and start shifting to kind of to support the interest of power itself. So again, I think that is an issue of degrees. It is very much the logic of practice, the practice of oppositionary players of various natures within zones of conflict, that starting to be to think and starting to come up with different ways of acting that attempt to evade that level of complicity within that. And in a sense, I'd like to take a very almost obvious material planning example, and obviously, you know, for me, it would be something from my own research from the West Bank, and to show the way in which the wall in itself, or kind of the story of the construction of the wall, has been kind of involved with these kinds of processes and stories. So although the very essence and presence of the wall, being built through Palestinian grounds in the West Bank, is an obvious material manifestation of state decision, of state power. If we look at the path of the wall, its changing path, one could see that it can never be said to have been master planned. In fact, if you look at the path of the wall that was authorized in 2002 and what is being built now, you would see massive and very, very significant transformations and modifications and constant kind of ways in which the path of the wall defines and cut new ways through the West Bank. In fact, the path of the wall can never be said to be the material embodiment of state ideology, such as, you know, the ideology of the Likud party or other parties in control of the government at the time. In fact, what it does, and that story has been for me the significant story regarding it, is a kind of a conflict between a variety of organizations, some of them state agencies, some of them independent organizations, some of them really the effect of international diplomacy, of legal action, the effect of human rights activists, and the effect of demonstrations as well, in the way that they have, that these kind of forces have constantly folded into the very path of the wall, right? So in a sense, all these agents, they're kind of the sum total of these, the work of these agents have finally become the path of the wall as we know it today, to a degree that even the Ministry of Defense, the Israeli Ministry of Defense agency responsible for its physical construction, has called it a political seismograph gone mad. Right? In a sense, we can read the transformation of the wall already as 5 minutes go very fast. Now, you know, if you think these are not significant, I would say the following statistics would show you that the part of the wall in 2002, really including the eastern part of the wall, included about 50% of the West Bank to Israeli, you know, to be annexed effectively to Israel, whereas at the end of 2006, we're speaking now about between 6 and 5% of it. So the transformation, these very transformation, I would argue, is what allowed the regime of the wall in itself to gain moral and legal legitimacy. In fact, the very fact that oppositionary action against the wall, on its you know, through the Israeli High Court of Justice, through various other kind of oppositionary mechanism, has had agency in transforming it, allowed Israel to actually argue for the project as a whole, right? It folded its opposition in it. The lesser evil approach towards the villagers that live along it allowed a greater evil to be imposed on the Palestinian as a whole. Improvement to the occupation somehow allowed it to happen. So I think that the kind of that flexibility of the wall, and here I mean not that its concrete elements are soft or pliable, but the part of the wall having ability to incorporate political forces into form is both empowering and frustrating. Obviously, it is empowering because it shows that there is agency, that if one is able to mobilize both international media, legal action against various paths, one has a physical, immediate kind of physical effect in improving the path. It is frustrating, obviously, because these actions become in themselves, and those organizations become part of the diffused, albeit collective, authorship of that element. So I think that here one is coming really at the heart of what is otherwise, and in different situations, has been called the humanitarian paradox. I mean, into what way would kind of little improvements, or here even a kind of significant improvement, would allow, would in effect endanger or stop serving the interest of people on the ground. And the question is really, what should one do? Should one stop doing that? And very often these questions have been posed to oppositionary groups in Israel and Palestine. When, for example, a village that has been cut away from its school by the path of the wall has asked organization to help it finance and build, architects were actually doing that, to build that school on its Palestinian side, the east side of the wall. Obviously, something like that allows the wall to even exist. It is what somehow makes it possible. In fact, moderating the path of the wall has been since 2003 adopted very much by the Israeli Ministry of Defense, so that humanitarianism and they've established a humanitarian office that in fact was dealing itself with so-called humanitarian problems that were created along the path. Now, what if you don't do it? If you don't do it, that means a series of other problems and questions. I mean, do you mobilize? In fact, are you seriously suggesting to mobilize the pain and suffering and problems of that Palestinian village for political purpose, right? Creating a situation which is unresolved in order to create an outrage that would allow the entire project to be effectively questioned. This is, in effect, it is kind of falling even into a system that has been called by some Marxists politics du pire, the politics of making things worse, of generating crisis so that with the kind of the political change would come faster. The worse things get, the deeper the crisis, the faster political change would come. Is it right to mobilize pain and suffering and anguish of others to hasten a kind of the end of occupation, in effect? And I think that is obviously a question that has to always be asked and always be present whenever one is engaging in any kind of intervention. I just want to note that there have been various ways in which various groups have kind of practiced that paradox, rather than kind of pushing it into.
It's okay. Just finish.
Rather than kind of pushing it into one extreme and saying, in fact, we will withdraw, allowing to kind of to work on various levels. The obvious one. Which always should be an option, is refusal. And even the International Committee of Red Cross engage in several one-day strikes in providing aids to Palestinians in Gaza in order to create a kind of, to manifest the sort of the urgency of their claim. So that kind of, you know, refusal is always there. Another one is, and I'll be very just brief on it, is that of witnessing. This is something that has been developed in the context, I think, of the Yugoslav War, where members of Médecins Sans Frontières realized that they needed to actually merge the role of the activist, or the kind of the medical professional, with that of the witness, and in fact report and insist on political responsibility on things and crime they actually see either in their very eyes or through as they actually register themselves in their medical report and medical situations. And perhaps to end with a way in which one organization in Israel has been working with that paradox, and this is that perhaps is kind of is inspirational, although you know the paradox still remain, and that is an organization called Israel Committee Against House Demolition, who is working simultaneously as an information center and as a kind of an aid agency. In fact, they are reconstructing homes of Palestinians that have been destroyed by Israel. But the very way in which they construct it and the location of their construction is aiming to induce the occupation forces to reveal their bureaucratical structure in a way that would not otherwise be apparent. So, in fact, they're kind of inducing information that would otherwise be opaque. So practice, their practice and their research kind of morph into each other in a way that one starts supporting the other. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, this is just before going to the, just a quick question there. I mean, it seems to me that actually the biggest, that a huge amount of evasions have already been sort of incorporated into the system of how it is being done. But the one that you just mentioned, how is it called? The agency for...
The
exactly. Israel Committee Against.
Okay, so tell me, can you just tell me, if you know, for everybody, how many people work there? Because for me, this is something that that really like makes the entire case, brings it to the different level of not just observing, but also operational level, then that may need its supervision or not. And if the supervision is taken away, then, of course, we talk about an amalgamation of one and the other. So I'm extremely curious into that, just technical aspect.
I mean, in a way, I think that the kind of discussion regarding humanitarianism around the wars in Yugoslavia has been a laboratory for these organizations, although they are not technically humanitarian organizations. They are, you know, kind of they operate in various other levels. The kind of the idea that one has to operate on various levels, right? Both on the level of aid, on the level of information. What they have done, and I think this is rather unique and interesting, is that their aid, they kind of they program it in a way that it becomes a tool of research. For them, practice become a way in which information that is essential for, you know, for further aid or for further kind of other actions is induced through practice. This is not a research. It is there's no research on the basis of which later kind of intervention is provided, but intervention is actually undertaken in order to induce the kind of information that is needed. So it's a, it inverses kind of research and practice in a way that I find rather productive.
Yeah, yeah. And also one more thing, quick thing about the relationship. What really strikes me is the relation between the lesser evil and making things worse. In that sense, what would you? How would you expand on the issue of the making things better? Is there anything that can actually emerge as? Does making things better means also accepting the lesser evil through decision-making or through actually deciding what is actually even going to be done?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, before any action, and this is the way it has as well been understood by various Palestinian organizations who sometimes work against international aid, that would not resolve the political... the fundamental political problem, but would just kind of ameliorate the situation on the way, is seen as a kind of a lesser evil approach, which in fact kind of normalizes and allows to extend the regime of occupation, right? So in effect, the danger of that, of moderation, is obviously a kind of the danger of, you know, normalizing a situation, naturalizing it, etc. Obviously, on the other hand, the other option is horrific. In fact, whether and that logic as well is as well one in which that is adopted by the militaries in control themselves in their attempt, as I mentioned, in 2003, the establishment of the kind of the head humanitarian office at the IDF and various kind of introduction of humanitarian rhetorics and practice into the IDF is exactly what, you know, attempts to take to a degree the horror out of the occupation and allow us to continue. But it would be, I think it would be ridiculous to completely sort of oppose that, right? And one need to understand how one operates within these contradictions rather than kind of rejecting them, you know, pushing the pendulum into one direction in order to avoid it. And again, I think, finally, it's a question of degrees and it's a question of judgment. Yeah. And one cannot avoid the question, you know, the kind of the necessity of making what you think at a particular time with a particular village or a particular situation is a responsible decision to take.
And which accepts also the issue of the master evader in the form of an organization. I would like to then switch to Keller Easterling and... I received a text from you. I think you're going to introduce the issue of the petrodollars. Please go ahead.
So they were kind enough to switch it. It's just a mouse click for that one. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. Thanks for doing that. many of my friends and colleagues who are here are already operating so well with within a certain species of political site that I suppose it is because of that that I feel somehow at liberty to wander off into another vast pasture of spatial political activity that... Another pasture of spatial political activity that is attractive to me actually precisely because it is a territory outlying the epistemes of war and the borders of nations. A territory that's also not so easily taxonomized by the left or the right or moralized by those two, or a territory outlying their purification rituals and their self-styled authenticity. In fact, it's a territory that in many ways doesn't have anything to do with the righteousness that sometimes accompanies those two clear camps, and is not governed by the binary antagonism that sometimes suffuses even our habits of mind and the way we, the forms of our argumentation. Not those logics, but really a territory governed by the logics of duplicity. You can go on to the next one. It's quite logical for any of us to fake it, to get through the day, and it's equally logical for global powers to juggle their multiple sovereignties with hypocrisy and duplicity. You know, for instance, the 90s idea somehow that the nation state, the power of the nation state was waning in relation to the waxing power of transnational forces, you know, is nowhere near sneaky enough. It's the ways in which the nation and transnational forces act together to decide how to cheat and shelter and occasionally release their power. They must work in tandem, acting together to give themselves a better camouflage so that they might shelter their money in an offshore zone while coming back home to kind of massage legislation that would give them NAFTA. So the stances of any one nation or a global power or consortium often, you can go to the next one, duplicitous or discrepant reflections of divided loyalties, of multiple sovereignties between citizens, between shareholders. So temporary conviction and duplicity, or to use the terms of this conference, evasion, are absolutely crucial to this kind of political agility. Most of my friends here already know that I've been. You can go on. I'm the subtle jester. Most of my friends know that I've been looking at special economic zones, free trade zones, export processing zones, etc. As an instrument of corporate externalizing. As an instrument of this kind of duplicitous sovereignty in all their variants, they incubate a more cunning sort of mongrel form of exception. It'd be wrong to say that it's exception proper, because it's much more sort of a multiplied condition of sneakiness rather than a single emergency of state. We also know that these zones are the primary aggregate of new global cities. But what's actually begun to interest me, go on. What's actually begun to interest me is the way in which not only are they new forms of global city, but more and more programs and spatial products thrive in this legal lacunae and political quarantine. I mean, what wouldn't enjoy the insulation and lubrication of their tax exemptions and foreign ownership of property and streamlined customs and no restrictions on labor or environment? So moreover, been interested in the ways in which they all together constitute a kind of global infrastructure of extra statecraft. You can go on. the zone, you know, is already, you know, calling itself a city. Breeding more promiscuously with other sort of parks or enclave formats. It's, you know, now not only sort of a transshipment facility or a corporate headquarter, but it's merging with tourist compounds and knowledge villages and IT campuses and museums and universities like my own. So that it's called, you know, High Tech City or Eben Cyber City or King Abdullah Economic City. And just in a row of a few of them, Gazprom City, you can see all of the Dubai cities, Internet City, etc. You can just go through those. This is power. I have only to move my hand. The zone is also now on vacation. It's able to materialize and dematerialize with the caprice of petrodollars. So as the corporate enclave merges with the resort, they also now sometimes assume this kind of ethereal aura and relay of fantasy for liberated money that can easily be maintained outside of the work week. For instance, this is Sayyad Island and the Pearl. In Oman, but this is King Abdullah Economic City. That's a sort of high production values of the Imar developers in the Red Sea near Yedda. Offers a full complement of programs. The fly through has swelling music, shimmering golden man-made island filled with Islamic palaces and programmed with leisure space and places to store your petrodollars. Off the coast of Iran, Kish Free Zone not only enjoys kind of notorious, relaxed religious restrictions, you don't have to wear a headscarf and so on, but you can also stay in the Dariush Grand Hotel that recreates the grandeur of Persian palaces and peristyle halls and gigantic sphinxes and bas-reliefs and so on. The fairy tales floating over a revenue stream, that's a common tool of evasive power, except that the evasion is the power. The zone is extra statecraft, kingdoms awakened by oil after the great centuries of national history and Westphalian sovereignty aren't so concerned with all the well-rehearsed techniques of national sovereignty like war, suffrage, diplomacy, franchise. There's no hand-wringing over that. There are other forms of extra state craft and global zone networks. Our architects are helping to provide symbolic capital. Indeed, some of it, you know, used to reflect the wise leadership of a nation who's smart enough to have zones. Also corporate consortia have their embassies in these zones, with real estate developers being able to provide them with a kind of their families of corporations with a recognizable environment. Corporate consortia have a kind of parastate function, enjoying kind of quasi-diplomatic elite status. Bouygues, Bin Laden, Mitsubishi, Kawasaki, Siemens, providing export transportation and communication infrastructure, relationships with the IMF, the World Bank. And the zone prefers non-state violence. War. We have to sort of retool for this species of political space. We have to retool our total war arguments that sometimes render infrastructure as only a military instrument, because it doesn't turn much information to this. Indeed, the arguments are actually even perfect camouflage for massively capitalized corporate conglomerates that avoid war because it's bad for business or get someone else to do their wars for them. And the non-state violence is harder to trace. It's often legal and relaxed maintenance of poverty as in the Makiyas, that avoid the chaos of informal economies. Or with the Al-Sunut development in Khartoum, it seems that the UAE in its partnership with this, at least here in Africa, does not intend to share its techniques for distributing oil wealth, but rather is exacerbating the problems of between the North and the South by building this massive, this is 1,600 acres of Abu Dhabi style, the Dubai style skyscrapers and residential properties. It's a little more of that. So you see fully developed entire cities, more, you can go on. The zone is a double also. Just to sort of make clear this idea that of absolute duplicity with the nation, mimicking world city paradigms like Hong Kong or Singapore or Dubai, the zone is now not only a newly minted city, but often a doppelganger of the national capital. Navi Mumbai, Shenzhen, Pudong, and now, going on, that's Navi Mumbai, and Shenzhen, Pudong. And now another that I'll just show you quickly, New Songdo City, which is an expansion of the Incheon free trade territories near design APF, aspires to the cosmopolitan urbanity of New York, Venice, Sydney, go on. And that's a film which sort of has a kind of, if you do a mouse click on it, I think the film will appear. Oops, no. Back one. Back one. Well, that might be. I was going to show you a film of New Songdo City prepared by the good offices of KPF, which with sort of a new age Sigur Ross music shows you a sort of sweeping vistas of this newly formed city that is itself a free trade zone, a doppelganger of Seoul, but has a canal street, a park avenue, a World Trade Tower, etc. They also have another version of it with kind of John Williams Bonanza-style music of the kind of non-state capital, the capital's own non-national territory within which to legitimize its non-state transactions. So it's it's clear that an unofficial transnational polity operates in this territory under rules native to discrepant or duplicitous territory. So righteous positions evaporate in these environments, but one wants to develop agile tools and impure ethical struggles or sleight of hand that might make an indirect political ricochet. Those are my remarks.
That's incredible. Actually, just to... There we go.
Yeah, this is it. Every one of these cities has a video like this, and they all start from the planet. So you don't need to look at it.
That's incredible. Well, they don't start from the solar system yet. My quick question before going to the next issue is that you also showed, of course I understand this is a particular relationship between the condition of the zone and the production of the zone, taking the Abu Dhabi and Dubai example. And then you just shown the images of the Gazprom city project.
Which is not a zone.
But it's an interesting way of the first extrapolation of the model into a continuation of another ideology. Can you expand on that? How do you situate that example, the failed example, so-called, in St. Petersburg? For everybody, the Gazprom city competition was one of the first and the largest competition in Russia that took place last year. And it ended up with a failure of good architecture, more or less, and the success of the model of the Dubai model. Now, can you have a quick...
Well, it's an interesting one in the sense, first of all, it's a state agency, so it's not really a zone. I cheated in showing you that, but that it's in many of the new developments of nation. Take, for instance, the new capital of Astana. You know, there is, and it somehow it's in my mind linked with Gazprom, because it is the state borrowing the techniques of the zone as part of its own self-promotion, and employing architects. Even here, and in some of these zones where there is obviously no participatory democracy, but there is participatory democracy in the sense that, in fact, in most of those cases, governing the zone is using a commercial apparatus or instrument, like a hotline or something, instead of means of voting. But in these cases, they're actually borrowing the techniques of participatory democracy to, you vote for the...
Which went all the way down to organizing an internet voting for the best project, which somehow quite suspiciously always went to the proposal that wins the project in that sense. That's quite fascinating. I would like to then somehow move on to the contribution of Manuel Hertz. I think that your thing is ready. I hope so.
Okay. This is part of an ongoing research into planning strategies of refugee camps and the dilemmas of, spaces of humanitarian aid. It's a bit, raw. It's unprocessed. It's much too much, so we're going to have a fight. Or until the microphone is switched off. It's a material which comes from a trip that I undertook in that region 2 weeks ago. So, like I said, it's a bit raw, and I hope that you bear with me. I'll start a bit... sort of the refugee camp is often ideally described as, the spatial manifestation of humanitarian aid and as the place to save lives. So immediately questions arise around the issues of temporality versus permanence. And the involvement of the camp within the conflict itself. I want to start briefly with placing the Western Sahara and the refugee camps around the Western Sahara into the conflict, into the history of the conflict. This is an official map of the UN showing the world in 1945 with all the dependencies, dependent countries, independent countries. Everything that is blue basically is an independent country. Everything that is red is a colony. The green, yellow ones are... countries which are not part of the UN. The world today UN map shows only one red territory. That is the only remaining, apart from dependent islands, it is the only remaining colony in the world, the Western Sahara. Next one. Next. It used to be a Spanish colony, it was partitioned in the famous conference which took place 1890 in Berlin and Potsdam, which divided up the continent of Africa, belonging to Spain. Spain took many years of trouble and warring to actually occupy that territory fully. In the last days of Franco's life, it sort of brokered a deal how to retreat from the territory, which was brokered basically with Mauritania and Morocco. Next one. Which 1974, 1975 invaded the country in the same days as Spain was moving out. And the country itself was at that time mostly inhabited by the Sahrawis, the name of the people living there. It's a group of people. How do you say tribe? It's a tribe folk of about 250,000. So it's extremely thinly populated, and they started a war basically against the occupation of Morocco and Mauritania. Fighting Mauritania successfully, but it was a purse victory, because immediately as Mauritania was retreating, Morocco moved in. Morocco moved in 1975 also not only militarily but also demographically, with 300,000 Moroccans in the famous Green March moving into the territory, thereby changing and shifting radically the demographic makeup of that area. Next one. Over the ensuing 10 to 15 years, the Polisario, that's the organization of the Sahrawis, fought a war against Morocco, and Morocco successfully sort of bit off more and more land and occupied more and more land by building a 2,500 kilometers wall through the desert, one of the most sort of absurd or crazy constructions maybe on this planet. You see the different successions or different locations of the wall, which continuously eat up more space of the Western Sahara. The Western Sahara is attractive for Morocco because it has extremely wealthy fishing grounds in the Atlantic Ocean. It has a lot of phosphate, the biggest phosphate-producing territory, and oil is also expected to be found there. Next one. This is the berm or the wall that Morocco built through the next one. Next. It's quite funny to see how Morocco represents itself with when you show when you see a Moroccan map. Obviously, there's no, not obviously, but there's no territorial boundary represented between the territory that it occupies and itself. Next one. 1991, a peace agreement or a ceasefire agreement was brokered, which is now overseen. Next one. By Minurso, a UN peacekeeping operation which has been in place since 1991. There was supposed to be a vote of independence, basically, by the people living in that territory, but that vote has been prolonged, delayed continuously by Morocco. Next one. So, next one. And the current condition is that Morocco occupies everything west of the built wall. Next one. And the Sahrawis claim so-called liberated territory east of the wall, which they can administer and use to their liking. Next one. 1975, the first refugees fled, or all the refugees basically fled to Algeria and set up four refugee camps in west of Algeria. Next one. And out of the 300,000 Sahrawis, about 200,000 fled to those four camps. Naming those four camps, next one, by four major cities which they had previously sort of occupied in their own country. Next one. Brokering a deal with Algeria, who gave them sovereignty, also state territorial sovereignty in those areas which lie within Algeria. Next one. And this is the land where those four refugee camps are located. Next one. These are some of the photographs from 1975 when they started building those refugee camps only with tents. Next one. You can sort of, it's a lot of images, so please sort of start flicking through. And these are now images which are current. So these refugee camps have existed now in the last 32 years in the most inhospitable place, basically, within the Sahara, which anyway is very inhospitable, and have slowly started building up an infrastructure of sort of mud houses, constructed from clay and tents. The climate is extreme, with about 0 degrees in the winter in the night and 55, 60 degrees Celsius, which I don't know what it. 180,000 in four camps. So in the summer it's just so incredibly hot, and the structure with a sort of a core settlement area, which is divided into quarters and maybe stop at the next one, into quarters and compounds, which are organized by roads and maybe you stop there, and sort of areas of camp quarters, always organized and served by service institutions, medical and school units in the center of those quarters. And the whole camps are surrounded by livestock, by goat, which sort of form a ring around the, all those four camps, which you see here, next one. And cemeteries, which are also located on the outside of the camps. Next one. The camps, what makes them very different from other refugee camps is that they are self-administered. In contrast to other refugee camps, they are not administered by UNHCR, but by their own organization, the Polisario, which is a very big difference. And Polisario started off with a Marxist ideology of no property, no ownership, no commerce. But 1991, when the soldiers of Polisario were coming back from the fighting into the camps, they allowed sort of own commerce, own business, independent business, and then also ownership of goods, not of land, to be introduced. So shops started emerging in the camp quarters. Next one. But now also in the sort of there's an area of shops, a commercial area, market area. Next one, which is actually equipped very quite well, considering where we are located. But the problem is that none of those goods can really be afforded by the average refugee family. But this commercial activity also introduced large diversities within the refugee population, people that are rich and people that are refugees that are comparably rich and refugees that are comparably poor. Next one. You can flick through. Next one. They started setting up an education system, which is extremely successful. Since they have been living in the refugee camps, the rate of illiteracy dropped from 90% to 5 or 6%. Next one. And the sort of the density of settlement, the Sahrawis originally a tribe, the density of the settlement allows them to build up communal services like hospitals, like those schools, next ones, which give the ability to achieve something like rather good medical services. Next one, please continue. Medical services, communication services, education services, and so on, which rely on those refugee camps. Next ones. Restaurants, next one. Sports facilities, next one. A floodlit football field, next one. Construction is always done by themselves. Next one. They mark out a territory within the refugee camp. They basically, it's quite a funny way of constructing. They find a sort of clay, a sort of sand with clay in the ground where they want to build the house, just dug out, and next one, and form bricks with water, let them dry in the sun, next one. It's a bit like Eisenman. Next one. Next one. And build their houses with basically just digging out what they find in the ground in front of them. So you always have big holes in front of every house. Next one. It's a bit of a recycling or forming process. Next one. But sometimes it does rain. And when it does rain, all the bricks disintegrate again into their original makeup or into the clay. Next one. Next one. Next one. It is in the last 35 years or 32 years, people who have accumulated a certain amount of wealth have invested a lot in transportation and in communication. So cars are ever present in the camp. Next ones. Next ones. Next one. And everything that goes with the cars, so there's an enormous amount of gasoline, petrol stations, next ones, and even a car wash in a refugee camp, next one, in the middle of the desert where there's no water, next one. Food is provided by Algeria mostly, next one, and by European, next one, European humanitarian organization. Next one. They have started a few agricultural projects, but they mostly fail. Next one. Yeah. Sorry, I'll buy time from Teddy or something. Next one. No, I have a few more slides. Give me a few minutes. okay, so go quickly. Most of the food stock is now empty. They are under major food crisis. Next ones. This is the mayor of the biggest refugee camp, Smara. In view of all this infrastructure that is being built up, I asked him. Continue, please. I asked him if he would define this camp as a city. After he had also quite proudly presented and explained to me all the services that are to be found there. By that question, he was almost insulted and said, "This has nothing to do with the city. There's no paved roads. There's no. It is nothing of a city. We will gladly leave it immediately when we're given the chance." So please bear with me a few more minutes. We now go into Western Sahara. There's two places, Bir Lakhlu and Tifariti, which form sort of the main locations, main settlements in the liberated territory of the Western Sahara. This is the border between Algeria and Western Sahara. Next one. This is Bir Lakhlu. This is the capital, quote-unquote, of the Western Sahara. Next one. We come across a very odd condition where the situation of the level of development in their liberated territory is actually far worse than whatever is found in the refugee camps. Next one. This is the wall between Morocco held territory and the Sahrawan held territory. And the liberated territories are intentionally kept empty. Even though there is no security problem anymore, they are intentionally not occupied by the... The refugees are intentionally not going back to their own liberated territory, but are housed there only temporarily. So the refugees are sent to the liberated territory for special events where, the refugees become displaced of their previous displacement and are housed in makeshift camps in the two cities of Bir Lakhlu and Tifariti. Continue. Which is, of course, a policy to of all or nothing, or what Eyal mentioned earlier, of to make things worse, not to occupy what could be occupied, not to start having half a state if you cannot have all the state. Next ones. And I'll end with a short narrative. The distance between, next one. The distance between three refugee camps, next one. El Ayun and Smara via Aswad is 42 kilometers, which is exactly the distance of a marathon. Next one. An organization started organizing a Sahara marathon to raise awareness and a solidarity which runs exactly through those three refugee camps. Next one. Bringing on the 25th of February this year 100 marathon runners from all over Europe to here, Algeria Airport. Next one. Into Smara refugee camp. Next one. Yes. Next one. And running through those three, this is me running the marathon. I think this race, and I have to stop, exhibits all the dilemmas and contradictions of humanitarian aid and humanitarian activities, shows how a camp is instrumentalized and how temporality is instrumentalized in order also by the refugees themselves and by their own organization and the 100 sweaty faces of Europeans running the marathon was quite the image maybe which condenses all of those paradoxes.
Thanks, Mama.
Sorry for...
That's okay. I think your material speaks for itself, actually. So I would like to go to Sanjay Krishnan.
Okay.
And...
Thanks. Fortunately, I've actually prepared a written text which will probably take less than 10 minutes to read out if I speed. Okay. We may wonder if, in practice, all discussions of the global that take globalization to refer to an empirical process are evasions of power, in the sense that they mask or obscure the workings of authority. It is apparently a neutral way of making sense of a process out there in the world might be grasped as the effect of a historically instituted mode of perspectivization. For the sake of today's discussion, let me propose that the global is a perspective self-consciously instituted during the era of modern European imperialism. As long as we do not think about the remote operations of this history, globalization is a term whose use evades or masks the operations of power, at once discursive and material, that discontinuously and unevenly relates imperialism to neoliberal capitalism and so forth. In the Anglo-American imperium, the world conceived in a global sense, a single, finite, interconnected, developing in common time and space, finds its most effective formulation in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, published in 1776. This work produces the global as a new way of comprehending Britain's relation to its far-flung colonies. The global operates here as an instituted perspective produced in response to a crisis of imperial governance, a crisis spectacularized by the impending loss of the North American colonies on the one hand, and on the other, the acquisition of a racially and religiously heterogeneous group of territories and peoples in Asia and elsewhere. Smith's work is a distant precursor of the global as instituted perspective. Its epistemic operation at the level of description and evaluation remains strong today, not least in the use of normative terms like global community, global culture, and so on. And one of the things that actually struck me about the presentation today, and I thought I'd take a moment to point to it, is the way in which two of our presenters produce photographs, for instance, whereby a certain way of presenting information as if it were given, a presentation of the world as such, or objects in the world as such, tacitly can operate to, on the one hand, serve as providing information, yes, about which we learn about things in the world, but in the process, because they do not question the perspective from which such knowledge or such operations are produced, end up reaffirming, if you like, tacitly, the instituted perspective that I'm talking about here. So in some ways, what I'm suggesting is not so much a refusal or a rejection of such representation, but asking precisely how the giving of the world as a self-evident object out there, you know, pictures of corporate brochures of hotels on the one hand, or refugee camps filmed at eye level, in quote-unquote objective sort of way, is in itself the activation of a perspective that one might call global, right? So this is the difference that I'm trying to get at here. If we consider the perspective of colonial subjects in Africa and Asia, or the formal schemata and rules, informal empire, indirect rule, caste, tribe, race, and so forth, by which the colonized were comprehended and made legible, first to the colonial state and its scholarly apparatuses, then to elite anti-colonial nationalists, and finally to the post-colonial state, we have a conception of the global as a set of discursive rules and operations through which a particular mode of perspectivizing the world is given, in which the world, as it were, is self-evidently made available. Truth effects at once local and global are produced in this process. Fleshed out through empiricist scholarship and policies, this mode of thematization is then offered forth as an adequate objective way of grasping the world as single, bounded, interconnected, developing in common time and space. Elite subjects across the colonial and colonizing worlds, trained to think and want in certain ways, are producers as the local dispensers of such seeing. The problem here is as much ideological as epistemic. In the post-colonial world, the issue is not just about whether such elites in the global north and south subscribe to modernization theory or free trade, for example, as it is about the ways in which they reflexively are trained to bring the world into adequate view. Local or so-called native agents, anti-colonial nationalists, post-colonial scholars, can refine and elaborate these categories in flexible ways that keep the basic lines of seeing and saying in place. This is why, to some extent, the impulses of those who straightforwardly oppose the local to the global in some self-evident way also seems to me misplaced. What interests me here is a kind of mixed practice, then. Since I've actually been speaking in somewhat stark or monochromatic terms, what interests me here is a kind of mixed practice that draws on the powerful schemata and rules of enunciation enabled by the global perspective, this way of actually producing and giving forth refugee camps, hotels, flows of power, and so on, even as it allows itself or asks the ways in which its mode of production or modes of seeing and saying may be interrupted, compromised, and reworked by the local sites in which it finds itself operating. The terms of this reworking or reconstellating cannot obviously be given in advance, since they are dependent upon the diverse, and here I'm thinking about global in a somewhat differently capacious sense, and perhaps one that points to the other sense of evasion here, by which it is confronted. In this light, my sense is that the global must be actively challenged and undermined, but not so as to be simply counterposed by celebratory conceptions of the global or forms of practice that do not necessarily reflect on their conditions of possibility. My interest is to displace, not reject, the global perspective and to see how it can be set to work in new and uneven ways. As someone who is trained as a literary critic, I am interested in asking how we can find ways to solicit, from within the perspectives afforded by globalization, the framing and thematizing devices at work in the production of the global. As I have suggested, this happens at both the national or regional levels, as much as at the level of multilateral organizations such as the World Bank or in fora such as these. How do texts read in literary fashion allow us to discern at an ironic or doubled remove the rules by which adequate thematization is produced? How do they enact or perform the instituting or setting up of truth, if you like, on the one hand, and on the other, the ways in which this truth might be displaced or aligned in new ways? This might require looking at the text's implication in the thing or process it describes, producing rather than simply representing the world as an object. In showing the ways in which the global or globalization is acted out and in the ways in which we are ourselves actively complicit in those forms of activation in the institutional situations which we find ourselves in, in showing the ways in which the global or globalization is acted out, we involve ourselves in ways of exploring how the rules of representation are set up, and we imagine how, when these rules are brought to the fore, the fabric or texture by which they are constituted, themselves offer or suggest ways for their own reconfiguration. I am thinking here of how a self-conscious practice or self-conscious practices that engage the global might seek to rework or undo the terms of an older configuration through which truth and historical effects are produced. Not so much the jettisoning of those older configurations, but a different relationship to them. When we see the rules of seeing, grasp that the rules of seeing of globalization or imperialism as its distant precursor are in a sense being played out within the literary work, we open ourselves to practices of thought and action that may not be confined either to literary texts or to the printed page, per se. It may have implications for engagement with and in different institutional and historical terrains. It is in these ways that I'm interested in how work in the humanities might teach us ways to redo, not reject, the global perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Sanjay. I just want to, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Just quick to clarify, since you referred to photography and so-called reproducibility of a situation, what did you mean by setting up the rules for reproduction? Can you just say something about that connection?
Oh, I meant it in a very sort of obvious and direct sense of the word, the way in which certain images are presented to us and the way in which a particular set of responses are already elicited in advance. So what offers itself as information or the sharing of knowledge is in itself a sample or a piece of evidence within the modes of knowledge production. Mm-hmm. So what is presented to us as knowledge, what is given for us to see and learn about new things, for instance, tacitly affirms a particular way of making sense of the world that has been in place for some time now.
Yeah. But also, I'm asking you this question because a lot of people I know from... One in particular from Kosovo, my friend Erzin Skololi, he, for example, refuses to make photographs of Kosovo while everybody else is photographing. And this refusal is, in a way, almost kind of not to be discussed. You cannot really... So I'm asking you, is this what you are talking? Is this an initiative or sort of a proposal that you are having or some sort of...
I don't have a proposal. I'm simply sort of... reading a text, if you like. I'm sort of saying, look at what kinds of practices and what kinds of, what forms of activation they enable. I'm not opposed to photography per se. I'm simply suggesting that how objects are produced and given to us might itself become an object of reflection, if you like.
Okay.
That's all.
Thanks. Yeah. Thank you. Laura Kurgan is our next presenter, please.
Am I the last?
You're the last.
On the panel? Okay. Can everyone hear me? Okay. So I probably have the wrong PowerPoint to be the last person on this panel because I feel as if the project that I'm working on, I've been working on for 2 years, and so there's sort of multiple iterations of how I could have presented it. And what I'm going to show you today is only the introduction, so that I can stick to the 10 minute segment. But I think, you know, by way of maybe responding to some of Sanjay's questions and bringing together the refugee camp on the one hand and and Keller's enclaves on the other. Maybe the question I can ask to both of you is, where are the prisons? You know, if a refugee camp has been around for 25 years, there must be some form of a prison. I don't know what it is. It would be really interesting to know. And the same thing with the so-called cities that you're showing. And what was stunning about the two presentations is that even though they're such completely different urban forms or whatever definition you want to give to them, are they cities, are they not cities, we both went through the same thing: culture, education, offices, retail, you know, all the things that were on that KPF little animation were in both presentations. So perhaps there is a way that the things that I'll show will bring together also Eyal's first question about some kind of information-based practice. I really want to know more about that Israeli committee of unbuilding or of rebuilding unbuilding, because I think it has a lot of reference to the way that cities get built after disasters and how you start to inform the things that you decide to demolish or that you decide to rebuild, which I think is a large part of what I might make reference to over here. So can I start the slides? Yeah, so this was... can you go back one? Can I go back? No. So let's just see what's there. Okay, what's next? Yeah, go next. Next, next. How do you know? I don't know. All right. So this was part of an exhibit. Some of the slides aren't working, apparently. That was at the... at the Architectural League of New York, which was the result of a two-year-long collaboration between the Spatial Information Design Lab and a criminal justice activist and another organization which links policy to cities. So I can go through that later. So in the United States, from the year 1970 to now, prison populations have increased from 200,000 to 2 million. Next. Okay. Can we go back one? Is it not shut? I don't know. This is weird. Okay. What was going to come before this slide is the definition of the word infrastructure according to the American Heritage Dictionary, which I wish I could read to you, but I can't. But the way that most of us think of the word infrastructure deals with roads, transportation, pipes, et cetera, in cities. But the American Heritage Dictionary includes education, housing, and prisons. And so it's no surprise that the word prison is built into this definition when you think about this increase in the prison population. And public housing in the United States currently shelters 3 million people. So the difference between people who are currently in prison and people who are in public housing is too close for cutting. Next. So this is where our project starts, where we take data which has been constructed to document people as they are incarcerated. So from a court system, they are incarcerated and they are sent to prison. Next. What we do with that data, what the data is just generally stored so that you can track a person over the course of their life in prison. But what we do with that data is we take the home address of the person who has just been sent to prison, generally far away from the city in which they live. Next. Okay, so this over here shows, the top graph is showing patterns in crime from 1970 to 2005, which you see just go up and down according to the vagaries of economics, whereas prison populations from the year 1970 to 2005 radically increase. Next. Okay, next. Next. So this is the way we've chosen to define cities, which I think both Keller and and Manuel left out. Like, where do you put where does governing crime or criminal justice come in? It has to come into every urban fabric. Next. Just go, keep going. Next. Okay, so this is where we were. Next. Okay, so what we've done with the home addresses of these incarcerated individuals who are being housed, in this case, this is Brooklyn, so they're being housed upstate New York, is to put it down as a point. Every home address or every person is now a point on the map. Next. And when you correlate that information with census blocks, next, and spatially join them to those census blocks, it's called an operation called spatial join, next. And then you grade, you give it a sense of an intensity of how many people are actually incarcerated on those blocks. You actually come up with a pattern which shows concentrations of people, next. In certain neighborhoods, which, while when you draw a crime map, next, this is a prison admissions map, next, and this is a crime map, you notice that it's spread much more pervasively throughout the city. So if you just couldn't just go back and forth between that one more time. Okay. So next. So with the thesis that we're trying to generate with this project is that crime geographies lead to crime prevention tactics like sending a police force, you know, quality of life, cleaning up the city. Next. While prison geographies lead to a new kind of orientation in looking at this problem through the lens of the city. Next. So prison geographies predict intersect with geographies of poverty and of neighborhoods of color. Next. So this is a map of people of color in Brooklyn. Next. This is a map of people living under the poverty level, and they're both correlated, next, with an admissions map. Next. So what we do is we then quantify how much it costs to send people to prison and add it up block by block, census block by census block. It costs $359 million to send people to prison from Brooklyn, and this was in the year 2003. Next. And this is what we now call a prison expenditure map, where we've calculated the amount of money it costs for every census block. Next. So from a demographic point of view, the spending facilitates a mass migration of people to prison, 95% of whom eventually return home. So the most, you could say that the most important institution inside of each of these neighborhoods, or the institution which the state is spending the largest amount of tax dollars, is outside of the city, while the problem or the concentrations are emanating inside the city. Next. So this is a map which describes that migration. Next. So then we started looking at one particular community district which has only 3.5% of the population, but 8.5% of a prison population in Brooklyn. Next. And again, zoom. Again, yeah. Next. those are the people. Next, this is how much it costs to send each of those people to prison for the life of that their sentence. Next. And these are the buildings which they happen to be living in. Next. So that particular image in those 11 census blocks, it cost $11 million to incarcerate people from those blocks. And we've given them a name. We call these million-dollar blocks. So it costs $1 million from that block to send people to prison. Next. So on a financial scale, and just repeating myself again, the prison is becoming the predominant governing institution in these neighborhoods. Next. But for lack of investment in resettlement, up to 40% of those who come home are eventually returned to prison. And that's a key point. Next. So this graph shows you that 25% of people actually go to prison for 1 to 3 years, and there's all these different cycles of migration in and out of the city. But most people who come home are eventually sent back to prison within a three-year cycle, because not because they've committed a new crime, but because they've broken their parole. Next. So the question that the project asks is what if more resources were organized around resettlement than around displacement, or how would these parts of the city look different? Next. It's just another visualization. Next. 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 Yeah. So I want to end on this slide just to remind you that this is actually a problem that comes back to haunt us through many different decades. And these are WPA posters from 1945 as the slums were being erased and housing projects were being built. The same questions were being asked, but the answers to the questions were to have people build giant WPA projects and not to incarcerate individuals. So the form of, whatever you want to call it, is different. And so what we're doing now as a continuation of the project is we realize that it's not a simple question that you can answer in the form of, of a map or even a series of questions, and we've tried to really open it up. And we've run a scenario planning workshop, which took place in the space of the gallery. And if you check back to our website in a couple of weeks, you could see the results of that. And we've also been studying 5 different states in the country, so that when you actually zoom in on these particular areas, you notice that all the million-dollar blocks are correlated with poverty and with people of color. But even though poverty looks different in all of these places, and that's what we're trying to do, we're trying to describe how they look different and actually what the architecture of that poverty is, but the response to poverty is always the same, which is incarceration. So.
Yeah, actually, I mean...
And we've also done this work in New Orleans as well.
Yeah. What I actually wanted to ask you, there was an attempt to show the city as a diagram. The diagram you showed I was sort of surprised to see the city in the center in the diagram you showed with 5...
You want to go back again?
Yeah, can you? I'm just curious what this diagram was, actually.
That's just showing... This is Community District 16, and that's just an extrusion of the building footprints. Yeah, that's all it is. With the data... underlay the million-dollar blocks data underlay. And that's the million-dollar blocks, right? So it's quantities. It's not normalized.
Yeah, right.
And so, but it locates which of the blocks you're, But it's done by, it's quantities, not normalized by population. So if you normalize that, you might find the per capita expenditure in some weird little row of brownstones. But I think highlighting the housing projects, you have to do that because I don't think every housing project in the city is the same, doesn't fall under a red splotch.
Yeah,
but
The volume is the representation of the actual building?
It's the building, yeah. It's just a 3D, it's just simple extrusion.
Because the question you're actually bringing, in fact, sort of like, you know, does it belong here and can the prisons really tie together? I was just thinking of this earlier diagram of infrastructure and where the city is usually shown as the center of all the services, right? So maybe you want to answer. I mean, this question seems to be perfect for each of you, maybe, to answer. Is there something of that is missing in all of our researches, looking at one particular area? Because that's what I feel very often, that I'm looking into something, right? And then you kind of come back and you look at another phenomena which has that aspect pretty well researched. And then you think of what are the points of, I want to say interchange, because I think that is not really operating, but sort of resonance between the two. But you had a question for the other presenters, which I think is a good question to answer.
Right, I mean, I guess the question is whether an enclave is a prison or a city, if you define both of them as a total community, and the same with the refugee camp.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to see if there is any question from the audience.